today, so.
Yeah, yeah, we have a long day.
Well, I left last night at 7:30.
Of the House Committee on Revenue is January 24th. We have an informational meeting this morning. Mr. Alamo.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The topics on the lineup today are the corporate excise and income tax, our taxes, and Kate Harger is going to go through that. And then we have an estate tax overview from Jamie McGovern. And I also want to point, I meant to point this out the past couple of days, within the meeting materials in OLIS, there is our 2019 basic facts. So for those who aren't familiar with it, it is a document that goes at a very high level through all of the major taxes in the state. So there's detail on the income tax, property tax, estate tax, marijuana, just the whole litany. So it's a good resource for an initial review of what a tax is and just some basic statistics. So it's something we update every year.
Thank you.
Cool.
Good.
Caitlin Harger, I'm with the Legislative Revenue Office, and today I will be presenting some information on corporate taxes in Oregon. I'm going to give a broad overview throughout the day today, so or throughout the next couple of minutes, not the whole day. Had you worried?
Oh, we're happy to be here with you all day.
Corporate taxes are just so much fun. So I wanted to briefly remind you that corporate tax revenue makes up about 6% of the general fund. And I know that you had an overview of that a few days ago.
Excuse me. We're having a little trouble hearing you up here. Is it possible to move the microphone a little?
Yes. Is that better?
Better.
Okay. Great. So today I'm going to start by talking through some taxation terminology. Then I'll go over a brief overview of corporate tax structure, including how taxation works, types of businesses, both for legal purposes and taxation purposes. And then finally, I'll end with some current statistics on corporate tax. So first, I have a long list of terminology that most of you have probably heard at some point before. I'm going to give you a refresher on what these terms mean and how they might relate to things coming up during the session. So first, I'll talk about what does it mean to be doing business in Oregon. I have the Department of Revenue definition here, and I've highlighted the words that I think are most important. When we talk about doing business, we're talking about someone engaging in profit-seeking activity within the state of Oregon. I've listed examples there for your reference later if you need them. Also, in statute, doing business is defined as transactions conducted within the state. So when we say that a company is doing business in Oregon, we're talking about transactions or profit-related activity occurring within the state of Oregon. So with corporate taxation, there are two types of taxes I'd like to mention, excise tax and income tax. And sometimes these are used interchangeably, but there are two separate taxes. An excise tax is a tax placed on corporations for the privilege of doing business within the state of Oregon. Most of the corporations in Oregon are excise taxpayers of the C-Corps. An income tax, on the other hand, is a tax on Oregon source income for companies that have that income but are not actually doing business in Oregon. So these are two types of taxes. They're usually referred to together. The large majority of this group would be excise taxpayers. I put the number and the net tax amount here for you to compare. And then another way to look at this is what percentage of the whole pie each of these categories makes up. So if we look at the left-hand panel, we've got this separated by number of returns, so how many filers we have in each category. And I've included corporate excise taxpayers, corporate income taxpayers. Insurance companies also pay excise tax as corporations, but they file a different form, so I've separated them out here. And then also S corporation taxpayers. So again, left-hand side, we're looking at the number of returns filed, and you can see that corporate excise and income tax make up about 30% of the returns that are filed in the state. And these data are from Department of Revenue for 2016. And I should have mentioned earlier, all of the data, unless otherwise mentioned, comes from Department of Revenue. So they've been very helpful in providing data to compile these reports. So if we look at the right side of this panel, now we have corporate tax revenue separated by the same categories, but now we're looking at revenue, so actual dollars, instead of numbers. Okay, and so you can see the big difference here is that 91% of our revenue comes from corporate excise and corporate income taxes. If we add in insurance excise taxes, we are now at 98%. And so S corporations actually only compile 2% of the revenue by filing status. So even though they file, S corporations file a large number of returns within the state, the revenue from those is smaller. And this is because S corporations are pass-through entities, and so they only pay an entity level minimum tax, typically on average, and instead the income is passed on to shareholders and then taxed through the personal income tax that you heard about yesterday. All right, so the next terminology I'd like to cover is, what do we mean by a unitary business or a unitary group? A unitary business is a business that shares one of the following with other businesses, and typically these are things like management structures, administrative services, or flow of resources between businesses. So these are businesses that are highly interrelated in production. And so then a unitary group would be a group of these businesses that are interrelated. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you so much. I love vocabulary. This is really, it's really good and grounding for us. Can you give me an example of a unitary business versus, and I don't mean to, I don't know if it's a public information thing, but like, for example, in Oregon, who is what would be an example of a unitary business versus a unitary group?
I will give a general example because I'm not sure that I can give a specific one. So suppose that I had a business making cupcakes. So I had a cupcakery and I sold only cupcakes. And then suppose I had a second business that used similar resources and I made bagels. So they're interrelated and maybe we share management across the two bakeries or administrative, like our accountant works for the same company, but these are interrelated in the way that they produce things. And I'm not sure if Chris would want to add anything to that definition.
Yeah, not to be pedantic about the terminology, it's whether a group of businesses would be considered unitary, mm-hmm. as opposed to a unitary business. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's when you have more than one company, or what can be viewed as more than one company, the bagel shop and the cupcake shop, but there's a common management structure, so they would file the same return because they would be considered unitary.
So if I know somebody who runs three different restaurants, owns and runs three different restaurants, they would be a unitary group. Would the restaurants be a unitary group, or would that person's business be a unitary business? I guess I'm just trying to tease out kind of the difference between that.
If the three of them, we'd be talking about C corporations.
Okay.
So if the restaurants were C corporations, and they all filed the same return, if they were all considered unitary, all kind of basically the same company, just different faces, then they would be considered unitary. Okay. And they would show up on the same return.
Okay. General Motors would be a unitary.
General Motors, I don't know the exact structure, but they probably have a lot of subsidiaries, right. And they would all file one return.
Like Burgerville, right? Like probably every Burgerville versus McDonald's, which is a franchisee. Burgerville, I would argue, is a...
Okay. Yeah, I wasn't sure if they were franchise, if those were franchises or not, but if they're all one company.
Okay.
Who runs the donut shop?
Thank you. I'll make sure we have samples next week.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
There's an incentive for 8:00.
And you're going to tell us why it's important that we know the difference between unitary and unitary group?
Now, yes. So the reason that unitary group and unitary businesses are important is because if we allow groups of businesses that are interrelated to file a tax return together, then we get into issues of apportionment. So one thing I want to point out moving forward, apportionment and allocation are two different terms. Allocation is used when we're talking about non-business income. So this is separate from this kind of unitary trail for a second. So allocation would be, let's say I have a clothing company and I have income from something unrelated to those clothing sales. So, for example, I have multiple locations, and one of the locations is vacant, so I rent that location out, and I have income from that rental. That rental income is not my primary business, and so this would be considered non-business income. And so this would fall under allocation of non-business income. Okay, so just be aware that these two words mean different things. So back to apportionment. Apportionment is how a state takes corporations' income that are, so for corporations that operate in multiple states, how Oregon would decide to apportion all of that multi-state income down to Oregon's level. In Oregon, we have what's called a 100% sales factor apportionment. If you look at the bottom of this table, so the table shows apportionment formula weights back in time. The bottom row shows where we are currently, and we've been at this single sales factor since 2005. And what this means is that whatever percent of your sales were included in Oregon or occurred in Oregon, we will take 100% of that for the apportionment. So if we have businesses that operate in multiple states, apportionment is important. Again, this is just kind of be aware of these distinctions between words. Tax liability and tax collections mean different things. And this is important, especially when we're talking about forecasting. So tax liability is also called net tax. And this is the amount of tax that's actually owed to the state. Whereas a tax collection is the amount of tax or the amount of money the state actually collects. So in theory, these two should be very closely aligned. However, if they're different, that can cause issues with forecasting later on. Okay, so when we're thinking about taxation, another important term is nexus. Nexus refers to whether or not the state has the authority to tax a business. If we have nexus, we would be on the left-hand side of this graphic, so yes, Oregon can tax the company. And if we don't have nexus, if the state does not have nexus, Oregon could not tax this company. And so there's some broad things related to nexus I'd like to talk about. The first, we'll talk specifically about the sale of tangible personal property. So in that case, Public Law 86272 says that if the only interaction a company has with the state is the sale of tangible personal property, then the state cannot tax that company. And sometimes you'll see this referred to as a corporation sales being exempt under Public Law 86272. A recent decision from the Supreme Court in South Dakota versus Wayfair argued or said that physical presence is not required to create substantial nexus, but it doesn't necessarily overrule Public Law 272. So there's still some recent activity here.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So I've heard a lot about Wayfair. I met the South Dakota representative who passed the original bill that they ran all the way through. I had thought of it as primarily an issue for sales tax and that it did not have a huge impact on our state because we do not do sales tax. But just reading that language under PL 86272, if we do single sales factor apportionment here, how does that get around PL? Well, maybe this is a bigger theoretical question. How does that get around the prohibition on if you don't have any presence here, but you just sell here?
I don't think it does. Oh. I mean, to your point, it was a use tax issue. Mm-hmm. And so once that was settled, then the question, there's always this comparison. Okay, well, if that's the case for use taxes, then what is the applicability, if any, to an income tax? Right. And we generally, there are some other issues like economic nexus when we're talking about intangibles, that get at what can or can't be taxed. So it's just something that's been mentioned, and we're trying to get the terminology out there so people are familiar. But you are correct. It was a use tax, mm-hmm. the sales and use tax decision. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
Tangible personal property. Now when we look at intangible sales, there are two more terms to know. There's a cost of performance approach to determining intangible sales, and this says that sales go to the state where the work was performed. And then there's also this market-based approach that says that sales go to the state where the customer received the benefit of the service. And recently, so in the 2017 session, Senate Bill 28 moved Oregon to this market-based approach. Okay, so we're going to now focus a little bit on this combined reporting unitary group information. So if we have nexus, we can tax a state. Now the question is, do we allow combined reporting or not? Oregon does allow corporations to file together as part of this unitary group. And as you can see from this pie chart, the states are almost split 50-50 about whether or not they allow this, but we are in the yes, combined reporting allowed side. So if we allow combined reporting, there are some specific issues that are important to think about. The first is the difference between the worldwide approach and the water's edge approach. The water's edge approach requires only U.S. members of a unitary group of businesses, so this interrelated group of businesses. We're only going to include those that are located inside the U.S. For this taxable income apportionment. Worldwide, as the name suggests, includes entities that are spread out across the world. So that's one set of terms, again, to be familiar with. Another set of terms that comes up during combined reporting is the difference between the Joyce method and the Finnegan method for apportionment. So the Joyce method considers each member of a unitary group separately when trying to determine which entities count for apportionment. So if we have three interrelated businesses, we will look at each corporation separately to determine if the sales count in this apportionment calculation. Whereas the Finnegan method suggests that if one counts, then all count. So these are two different methods of dealing with apportionment. I know it was a lot. Now I'll talk a little bit about the structure of corporate tax in Oregon. So types of businesses, when I first started studying this, I had a lot of questions for Chris about the types of businesses I was familiar with in legal status and the types of businesses we deal with in corporate status. So for a second, I want to just distinguish between the two. For legal purposes, we have things like sole proprietorships, partnerships, LLPs, LLCs. We also have corporations and S corporations. For taxation purposes, we're going to define things a little bit differently, or the corporate side will focus on things a little bit differently. For S corporations, quickly, I just want to review what an S corporation is. This is a pass-through entity, meaning the income or losses from the company are passed through to shareholders, and thus S corporations are taxed at the personal income tax level, other than that minimum tax I mentioned earlier. So in some way, they avoid the type of double taxation that a C corporation faces. And there are some pretty strict rules about what classifies a corporation as an S corporation. Okay. So when we talk about corporate taxation, we have C corporations and S corporations. As I mentioned, S corporations typically only pay the minimum tax under our system, and then their earnings are taxed during the personal income tax side. C corporations are split in terms of filing into excise and income taxpayers, which we talked about earlier, insurance corporations. And so for all of these C corporations, an entity level tax does exist. So again, just to emphasize how these are split up in terms of filing, C corporations, traditional C corporations file an OR-20 form. That's the corporate excise tax. Moving to the right, we have then the corporate income tax, the insurance filers, and the S corporations.
I'd like to stop you there for a moment. Mm-hmm. And a question for either you or Mr. Alanak. Could you explain the rationale or the history behind insurance corporations being separated out from all other kinds of corporations?
Madam Chair, perhaps the easiest way to think about it is for the excise tax filers, those companies file a certain federal form and they calculate federal taxable income. And then we tie to that and then we make any adjustments and get to our tax. And then the insurance companies, our tie is in that they file a different form, and we actually, our starting point is the annual statement for the insurance companies. And I think a lot of it has to do with just the nature and structure of where the income streams for the insurance companies.
They file a different form federally?
Yes.
That's really how it got started. It's because of the federal environment and how we relate to that.
I think so, but it's also part of where they get the income from. So a traditional company that sells cupcakes or any other services, a lot of the income from the insurance, it's a unique kind of structure given that they're selling premiums. And a lot of states actually don't tax them through the income. They tax them gross premiums tax. And so we used to have, the state used to have a gross premiums tax, and then in the late 90s, we moved away from the gross premium tax and pulled them into the income tax structure. And so that's part of the, they didn't even file this form if we go back far enough.
A little bit more about the overview of corporate tax filings in Oregon. So if we have a C corporation and they are doing business within Oregon, then they are paying the corporate excise tax, which is that OR-20 form we talked about earlier. If I have a C corporation and they're not doing business in Oregon and they have income from an Oregon source, then they would file this corporate income tax. And again, these two terms are often used interchangeably, and the large majority are corporate excise taxpayers. I just talked through that. So Department of Revenue in Oregon produces this flow chart that I think is helpful for illustrating how taxation works. So I'm going to talk through this along with some important characteristics or information. So like Chris mentioned, for corporate tax filers, we start with federal taxable income, and then we have Oregon additions and subtractions. So Oregon additions would be things that Oregon wants to tax, but the federal government is not taxing. Oregon subtractions are the opposite. So we make these Oregon adjustments, and then we get to the apportionment percent that we've talked about earlier. So with apportionment, does the relevant questions are, does the corporation operate only in Oregon? If they only operate in Oregon, then the corporation will be taxed on all of their sales, because all of their sales are related to Oregon. If the corporation operates outside of Oregon, in addition to inside of Oregon, so multi-state or multinational, then the corporation is taxed on the percentage of total sales attributable to Oregon. That's our apportionment percent. This is simpler in some ways because we're at 100% sales apportionment ratio, so we just have the percent here. So that takes us to this next part, which is the net loss deduction. Briefly, for a reminder, operating losses and capital losses could be deducted here. Operating losses can be carried forward but cannot be carried backward. And the time frame on the carry forward is up to 15 years, whereas capital losses can be carried forward and backward, but the time frame is more constrained. And they're only applied to reduce the amount of capital gains income, so they're dealt with a little bit differently. So that takes us to Oregon taxable income. From there, we apply the tax rate. The current tax rate schedule is 6.6% of taxable income up to $1 million. And then over $1 million in taxable income, you pay 7.6% on that amount that you are over that threshold. Okay, so that's how the tax rates apply to corporate excise taxpayers. Then any tax credits that a corporation has are applied to the Oregon tax before credits. Just so that you have a list, I've listed corporate tax credits that are still available, meaning they're ongoing. And then also on the next slide, I have corporate tax credits that are for carry forward only. So these have ended or sunsetted, but they still can potentially affect revenue.
Chair, just a few questions. If we can go back to the structure of S-corp filings and both the excise tax and corporate income tax, which is, I forgot what page that is. The structure of C-corp tax filing. Oh, okay. Anyway, my question is, can you give an example of the two types of, like, real-world businesses that, just examples of which one would do an excise tax and which one would do a corporate tax?
Yes. So I'll give a general example because I'm not sure that I can give a name an actual company. But corporate excise tax would be a corporation that has Oregon sales. So let's say there's a grocery chain or a clothing store, someone that's selling in Oregon. They would pay the corporate excise tax here, which is the bottom left square. Now, if a company is not selling in Oregon but has income from an Oregon source, so perhaps they, and Chris might have to correct me if this isn't accurate, but perhaps they sell real estate in Oregon, and so they use that income to fund their business in another state. Then they have income from an Oregon source so that they are in some way benefiting from the Oregon economy, and so they would be a corporate income taxpayer. Is that accurate?
Rental income, if they're not in the business of rental income, but they happen to own a warehouse in Oregon and they're renting it out, but that's not their business.
Did you have a slide where you showed the relative amount of corporate income versus excise?
Yes, and I can go back to
that. Thank you.
So on this slide, I've got on the left-hand side the number of returns, so the number of filers, and on the right-hand side, the revenue by filing status. So those corporate income taxpayers make up 1%, actually of both. So they're a very small amount relative to the total revenue and even the number of filers.
Great. Thanks.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
In the operating losses and capital losses, could you just give real world examples of what those could look like if you're one of those businesses?
Mm-hmm. So for an operating loss, this would be a loss associated with running your type of business. So if I am a large clothing retailer and I have a loss in a given time period because I bought a lot of inventory and I didn't sell it, or I sold it at an amount that would result in me having a loss, an operating loss is directly related to my business. A capital loss would be something, I think, related to, I guess, selling a capital good at an amount that made you be in a loss. Like, I would think real estate or machinery or something like that. Is that accurate?
Capital gains and loss kind of situation.
Follow up, Madam Chair. In the goal of whoever created this system was to help businesses, you know, if they have bad years, continue for the benefit of the country, I guess. What was the context of creating these offsets or losses?
We can do a little more research and get to the origin of creating it. But the idea was there for a bad year. Usually it's recession related, or if there are losses there, and they could offset future gains to account for those losses. But we can do a little more research and get you detail on where that policy originated.
And Madam Chair, just quickly, it doesn't have to be I don't want you all to do extra work. It could be very high level.
Sure.
I'm going to posit a situation. I'm picturing, and let me know if this is correct. I'm picturing that over the last 10 years, as we have seen the growth of online or internet-based sales replace some place-based or brick-and-mortar sales, that we would probably expect to see an increasing amount of capital losses claimed as companies with storefronts, maybe they have several, and as they shrink the number of satellite facilities or places where they're doing place-based sales, we'd probably see them as they sell off and maybe at less than what they had to pay to purchase the property. We'd start to see how this big shift, cultural and social shift due to technology, we'll start to see it show up in this area, I would assume. Is that correct?
Well, without having the data in front of me, I'm not 100% sure, but I think theoretically it's possible.
And we can look into the data and get that report back to the committee.
Because at some point, when we're thinking about how our revenue system is designed, is it serving us in the social and economic and technology environment that we have now versus when the system was created 10 or 20 or 80 decades ago? Thank you.
So I think I ended with tax credits, and there's a list here. Again, carry forward only are credits that have been sunsetted or have ended, but they could still be affecting revenue today, depending on credit claims. And so then finally, that gets us to our Oregon tax amount. And as you can see, it's either Oregon tax or minimum tax, and a corporation would pay the higher of those two amounts. Our minimum tax schedule is a tiered tax schedule based on Oregon sales. So for example, if a company had Oregon sales of $100,000 and their calculated Oregon tax was $50, the minimum tax here in that bracket is $150, and so the company would pay the minimum tax.
Yes.
Is that additional to the fee for filing as a business in Oregon, or are we calling it the same thing?
I believe they're separate. This is the tax liability for that company, not the fee. So important distinction here. C corporations paying excise tax follow this schedule, so this table here. S corporations have a minimum tax of $150 currently, and those corporate income filers have no minimum tax. So just thinking about these different structures, corporate excise taxpayers, which are the large majority of our revenue, and about 30% of the filers within corporate tax pay or have this minimum structure. S-corps have $150 minimum tax currently, and the income filers, C-corporation income filers, have no minimum currently. All right, and so now I'm to the current statistics.
Zero, in theory.
In theory, yes. Mm-hmm. So now some current statistics on corporate tax. First, I'll start with a brief comparison to other states. So if we look at the top corporate tax rate as a percent by state in 2018, Oregon's right kind of in the middle here with a top tax rate of 7.6%. Then if we look at corporate tax revenue as a percentage of state revenue, we see almost the same distribution. Oregon tends to be in the center. Another way to
I just want to make sure I thoroughly understand this chart. So of Oregon's total state revenue, only 3.4% of it comes from corporate taxation.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Thank That's you. Correct. Sorry, I didn't mean to slow us up. No, sure.
But thank you for raising that. C corp or all corporate?
So this is data from a I think the Tax Foundation, so a national tax analysis group. I believe
the cost?
No, it's publicly provided.
No, I mean Council on State Taxation. Is it that group?
No.
Tax Foundation.
I think it's the Tax Foundation. Group.
Sorry.
Mm-hmm. It's okay. So within here, I believe they're referring to corporate excise and income because it's all corporate taxes. But when we looked at the beginning within general fund revenue for the state, corporate taxes make up 6%. So they're looking at a more broad base, which gets to Representative Smith's question. So another way to look at tax liability in Oregon is to split businesses out by the type of sales or ownership that they have. So if we first look at the left-hand side panel, which again is the number of returns, similar to earlier, Oregon only refers to businesses that are located in Oregon and operate only within Oregon. Other multi-state would be businesses that are located outside of Oregon and operate both in Oregon and in other places. And then Oregon multi-state are Oregon-located companies that operate both within Oregon and outside of Oregon. So you can see on the left panel, we're almost split down the middle between Oregon-only filers and the other types of filers. Whereas on the right-hand side, we've got, the right-hand side is the tax liability, the revenue from these different categories, and most of the revenue comes from other multi-state filers. So these are companies that are located outside of Oregon but sell into Oregon and elsewhere. If we look at corporate tax collections over time, you can see that they are increasing, the general trend here. Corporate tax collections from 17 to 18 are estimated to be $737 million.
Can I put on my ways and means hat really quick?
Sure.
Can we go back to that previous slide? I think it's really important for this committee and for the whole legislative assembly to understand our general fund portion that funds education and public safety and senior and disability services, disabled services, is about $25 billion in general. And if I read this correctly, of that $25 billion, $737 million of it helps fund that activity. And so I think it's really important for folks to understand, based upon that general fund, how much is really coming from corporate versus the personal versus lottery as well. Here, I just wanted to slow up and make sure folks really understood that corporate's paying this much, personal's paying this much, and lottery's probably paying that much.
Thank you. And just to add to that, I was reflecting back on a slide we saw, has it been 2 days already? Which showed the increase in personal income tax and the increase in corporate tax. And although we see an increase, it's quite gradual compared to the increase that we've seen in the personal income tax.
Madam Chair, thank you. Go back one again. So it'd be interesting to take a look at this slide versus the personal income tax numbers, not just as far as numbers, but the shape of the curve. So in the recession of 10, 11, 12, and part of 13, it sort of dips here, but I'm assuming that personal income tax really dropped off.
And we can put those on the same scale. Yeah,
and same scales, just so we can see the shape of the curves, see what happens when or if. Thank you.
Thank you. I also wanted to provide a little information about the distribution by industry. So in this figure, which comes from our basic facts report for 2018, we have 2016 numbers, and this is the number of filers, not the amount of revenue, by C corporation and S corporation status. So again, you can see we have a lot of S corporations and how the industries are distributed.
I would really love to see, not today, a bar chart by year, maybe not every single year, but a snapshot every 2 years or 5 years, to see how this makeup of filers has changed as Oregon's economy has changed.
Have another fantasy bar chart. In addition, I love that idea as well. Because I always try to think about percentages. If you could do a version of this that, instead of me trying to do the math on each one, tells me what percentage of each. So, for example, professional scientific and tech services. Visually, I can see that there's a lot more S corps than C corps. But if you could put a little just of that, what percentage, like the little number of percentage in each part.
It's one little click in the attribute.
Right, that's right. So if you could do it from numeric to the percentage for each of those bars as well, that would be really helpful. Thank
you. Absolutely.
Or maybe the Madam Chair is going to do it for me instead.
No, but Caitlin will be happy to do that.
Thank you.
Yes, I'm very happy to do that. All right, and on the next slide here, I have C corporations. Now this is net tax or tax liability by industry, and this is just C corporations. And these data are from Department of Revenue for 2016, and again, this is in our recent basic facts report. So as you can see here, there's this distribution within industries that's similar to what we saw in the number of filers, but not the same.
Can you give us just a minute?
Of course.
This also would be interesting to see over time.
Absolutely.
Sometimes the most interesting information is that which floats to the top or sinks to the bottom. So when I see unknown, of course I'm going to ask, what do you mean unknown? They don't know what they're doing, or we don't know what they're doing. So is this just some little aberration with data that's coming in from Department of Revenue, that there's some little piece of data missing or a category mislabeled or something?
I believe so.
Generally, the sector is self-reported, and then the Department of Revenue, the research section, actually does a fair amount of work trying to link that information with the Employment Department, because the Employment Department has a wealth of data by sector. So they try to line those up. They focus on the large ones, the large dollar amounts, and then at the end, the unknown. In terms of tax, it's a little blip there, but it might be several thousand very small companies.
It just didn't check a box somewhere, or
they didn't match. The data are never as clean as non-users would think. Once you get in there, you realize how messy and complicated it is, and that's why they focus on the large ones first. Mm-hmm. And their resource limitations to get everything worked out.
And I expect that this kind of thing will change, because 2016, Department of Revenue still had not finished implementation of the new system. Is that right? Or had they by that year?
Well, this,
by that tax year?
I'm not sure. You're talking about their GenTax system.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that shouldn't have an effect on this, because this is just the companies. This is reflective of the economy in Oregon,
yeah,
and the tax structure. The largest historical change probably would have been when we converted to the single sales factor.
Okay.
And now we see a lot of concentration, for example, in the wholesale sector. That's probably more now under a single sales factor than it might have been before. Part of the argument for moving to a single sales factor was to encourage investment in the state. So some of that should have been shifting from the manufacturing sector, say, to the trade sector. But looking back at time, that's the kind of thing that you would see.
Okay, thanks. Yes, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can we go back one, back to the slide I was commenting on? Perfect. Is there any way to determine? Let me digress. I'm thinking about our $25 billion general fund, and I'm seeing that $737 million of it is corporate tax collections. Is there any way to figure out what portion of tax collections come from LLCs, from sole proprietors, from partnerships, from the different business types as it relates to the total general fund? Or is that just too hard of a number to grab?
We can make estimates. The C-Corps are clean because they're a separate return to total that up. Once you get into the pass-through income, that shows up on the income tax side. So as a rule of thumb, when we've looked at it, it's about 10% of the personal income tax comes from businesses. So that would be all the pass-through entities, and including sole proprietors. And we get into this world of estimation there, because on the personal income tax side, that income is thrown into the same bucket, mm-hmm, as all of the other income. Mm-hmm. And then it all gets the same color and gets taxed under that system. So teasing that out, we can make estimates. It's not an accounting process, it's an, mm-hmm, estimation process.
How challenging would it be to do that?
We've done some of it. We can kind of check on that work. We can certainly get back to you with some estimates.
Here's where I am, Madam Chair. I'm really interested, but not to the point of creating a challenging task for your staff. And so if it's something that could be relatively easy to complete, I'd love to see that.
Sure. We can certainly make some estimates. I mean, I've done that a little bit in the past. I think we can refine it a little bit and then share that along with the caveats and understanding that it is an estimating process as opposed to this is a reporting.
You bet. You bet. Again, I just want to be sensitive to workload on that. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to this chart, I'm trying to understand it in the sense that the year or the timeline along the bottom, it looked at first to me that it was by biennia. But then you see like 09s and 1, and then it's 09 and the next one, and then 10, and then 10, and 11, and 11. So is this by year, or is it by biennia? And if it's by year, then we have to multiply it times 2 to compare it to what Representative Smith is talking about, because he's talking about our budget and the biennium, as opposed to this looks like it's annual data.
It's a tax year.
Yeah. The these are by year on a biennial basis, the corporate collection is about $1.2 billion.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
Indeed, you'd have to double it.
Double it.
You would need to double it for the biennial, okay. Roughly speaking.
Okay, thank you.
So of the $25 billion, we're not talking 25%, we're talking 12%.
Well, about how much? 1.2 out of 25.
Less.
It's
4%,
right?
4%. Yeah, much lower.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
Interesting.
And then finally, I have two more slides on corporate tax credit use in Oregon. I mentioned some of the tax credits earlier. And this bar chart shows the percent of filers using credits, whether they use credits at all, separated by income group.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is fascinating. Do we have an amount of what these credits mean in terms of money, so we can put it into context of
yes,
tax expenditures report. You might use it as a doorstop or something. Really big.
I know, and I mean, and maybe just the amount of the total money that those credits equate to.
And the Department of Revenue, and I think we have copies of a publication over here. They put out a corporate annual statistics, and they just released the latest version. And within that, it has the total amount of tax credits. I don't have it at my hand right here, but you can get that to you pretty quickly.
And I'm sorry, follow up, Madam Chair. And I say that to if the folks in my district were to look at this, they would ask a lot of questions, but probably make assumptions about what, you know, the wealthier, the more money, the more credits we give, the more money back we give back. And so having actual context to be able to understand how much money that is and what they are and why.
And one thing to keep in that, and we can get you that information, and that we have those figures. Mm-hmm. And one thing to keep in mind, this is information from tax year 2016. There is a significant lag for the corporate data because corporations can choose their fiscal year. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the Department of Revenue just released the 2016 data.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have that, and those are real numbers. We've also had the tax credit review process where a number of tax credits have been allowed to sunset. So that's something you just want to keep in mind as talking with constituents. There can be a big difference between the amount of tax credits that were granted in 2016 and then the amount that we're expecting to hit the revenue system in 2019 and 2020.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a large constituency that says tax the rich. So I like data and figures and be able to understand it all so that, you know, we could give accurate information. Not that I don't support taxing the rich, I'm just...
Thank you. I can absolutely provide those estimates. And so this slide, I'm looking at the percent of filers using credits at all, not the amount that, like Representative Fernandez was referring to. So this is the number of filers compared to the total filers within each group using credits. Then on the next slide, I've restricted this to the percent of credits used, again, by income group, but these are only considering people using credits. So it's a similar figure, but now we're looking at conditional on the fact that you used a credit. What did you look like compared to the others in your group? And so we see a similar trend, but a more drastic change here.
I don't really understand this one.
So just to elaborate, or I want to make sure I'm being really clear here. This slide shows the percent of filers using credits separated by income group. So each one of these bars looks at every filer in that group. And if you used a credit, you're counted. And so you're comparing the number that used a credit to the total number of filers within the group. On the next slide, we're looking at only the filers within that group that used credits. What percent of the credits did they use? And so this gets a little bit to the question that was asked earlier with amounts.
Say it in a different way. What do you mean, what percent of the credits?
So within each bar, we're looking at only the number of filers that used credits, so only people using credits on the slide. And here we're looking at, or I have information on the amount of credits used. And so this is based on the total amount they could use. I think this is DOR data. This looks at the amount that they did use based on the total that was available.
What do you mean by amount?
I try.
Yes.
With all due respect, thank you for even figuring out to make this a slide. So if you just said there were 100 tax credits used, 62 of them were used by people with over 25 million, another 22 of them were used by the 10. It's the, if all the number of tax, if there were, it is like a pie chart. No, it's tax credits. So if there were this many tax credits, 60% of them were used by people over 25 million, making over 25 million. Another 27% were used by people making 10 to 25. But it's more a pie chart. I think it might show up better in a pie chart than that bar chart. Did that
help? It makes sense.
Yeah, it took quite a few thinkings to get to that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And may I just make an assumption, and then you can correct me if I'm wrong, is the higher your income bracket, the more tax credits are available to you in the code. So if I make $50,000, the amount of tax credits available to me to take advantage of are going to be less. That universe is going to be less than if I make $50 million. Is that a valid assumption?
This can provide some more information. I don't know that I have that data in front of me.
I'm saying because we're counting tax credits, right? We're not counting dollar amounts. We're just top. So did you take advantage of a tax credit? And I'm saying if you make more money, $50 million versus $50,000, the available universe of tax credits gets substantially larger the larger my business gets.
In this. Yes, in the sense that you have more income to use, that you have more ability to use the credits.
The credits
aren't, I can't think of a credit that's a function of income,
okay,
per se. But if I have more income, I can use more credits.
Okay.
And therefore more liability. Because the more liability I have, the more tax credit.
Okay, thank you.
And I believe that was my last slide. So thank you for your time.
So I, going ahead in the presentation that's online, there are a lot of things called extra slides.
Those were there just in case I got questions about specific detail-oriented things. So I can, if there are any that you'd like me to talk through, I'm happy to do so, but just tried, since I'm new to this, have some extras in case I was asked about more detail specific things.
In looking ahead, there is one I'd like you to review with us. It says history of minimum tax and use of tax credits.
Mm-hmm.
I think just given some of the questions that have come up, I think it would be nice to continue your conversation here.
Thank you, Chair. So on this slide, I've got three time periods. I think the most important thing at the bottom down here is that as of now, you cannot use a tax credit to prevent yourself, or a company cannot use a tax credit to avoid the minimum tax. That's the big picture here. So in 2013, the Oregon Tax Court ruled that tax credits can be applied to minimum tax. So perhaps my minimum tax is $1,500 and I have a tax credit for $1,400. Under that ruling, I wouldn't actually be paying the minimum tax. I would be paying the minimum tax net tax credits.
You write a check for $100.
Mm-hmm, in the example I gave, absolutely. And so in 2015, the legislator modified this on a temporary basis for 2015 to 2020. And then in 2017, this change was made permanent. So now tax credits cannot be used against the minimum tax amount for a company. And this gets back to the DOR flowchart that I think is really helpful to look at how taxation works. So as you can see down here, the bottom block they have is Oregon tax, which cannot be less than minimum tax. And so in earlier years when the court made this ruling, that was not the case. But today, it is the case. You cannot use a credit against minimum tax.
But the credit is retained as a carry forward
mm-hmm.
for the future?
Mm-hmm. Depending on how much you use, yes, and whether or not that credit is sunsetting and when it sunsets.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you for the presentation. Mr. Alanak, is there anything that came up from our conversation today that you'd like to amplify on?
I think this is the kind of going over the vocabulary. This corporate taxation gets pretty complicated pretty quickly, and there are likely, I've seen a couple of bills, I don't know if the committee will hear them, related to moving from Water's Edge to worldwide reporting, mm-hmm. moving from Joyce to Finnegan, and we will certainly have more time to get into more detail on those issues, but this was really just an initial, here are some concepts that are out there that the committee may encounter.
Good. Yes.
Madam Chair, I think some of your questions, and maybe I'm wrong, about the history of what's happened to industry in Oregon over time, how those bars grow and shrink, as well as whether they end up being, the newer businesses end up being passed through entities versus traditional C-Corps, is critical in us understanding if we move a lever here or there, how that's going to affect an industry that may be doing really well in Oregon because of our current tax structure, and by moving that little lever may hamper it while we think it's going to help the overall revenue picture for Oregon. So I just think that's critical information to understand which industries have been growing in Oregon the last 20 years. And I think S-Corps and LLCs and LLPs, those are new entities within the last 30 years in Oregon. I mean, so if you go to businesses created in 1979, probably all of them were C-Corps because that's all that was available. And so they built their business around this model. And anyways, it's just something to think about.
And we do see, generally speaking, we have, most recently, there are 30,000 C-Corps, 65,000 partnerships, and 65,000 S-Corps. And there is growth in the number of S-Corps and partnerships, and the C-Corps continues a long decline. And we have a chart in our basic facts book that actually shows a decline in C-Corps of a percent or two over time. It's kind of a steady decline. But we're roughly thinking, using round numbers, 30,000 C-Corps and 60,000 to 70,000 partnerships and S-Corps.
Because the tech bar in that one, I think it was the services and tech bar, was the largest, and the largest part of that was S-Corp, it wasn't C-Corp.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
It would be great to, I really appreciate this context and this information about our current systems, but the why component to it, like how, the historical context, I think is key. Well, who were the folks that made these decisions, and what kind of, I know this may be very challenging, but socio-political environments were these systems created in? For what purpose, what intention? Who were the decision makers? And I think that will help us contextually understand where we're at now and why we have the challenges we do. And then I'm not sure if anybody else wants that type of information, but as a younger person, some of these things are way older than me, and it'd be interesting to know why they were developed and why those systems continue.
Any additional discussion? We're done with our
Well, we have the estate tax.
With this topic, are we coming back to, for informational hearings, we're done with this topic in this context until we start hearing bills, correct?
Correct. That was the initial plan.
All right. Yeah. All right. So the next presenter, right? And I did not look ahead to see how many slides. I hope I've left you enough time.
No. Madam Chair,
Jamie McGovern, Legislative Revenue Office. In graduate school, my professors told me it doesn't really matter how many questions are on the exam, because one question could take us 4 hours. So I don't think I have as many slides as Kate. Depend on the level of and depth of questions that you have and what I am able to answer, what I might have to come back to you with. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks for having me. I'm going to give a history and primer and a little bit of current events and estate taxes. I know that some of you have seen some of these presentations before. I thank you for sitting through with this again. The chair has requested a bit of an update. Okay, so I'm going to start off with the definitions of three related taxes. In Oregon, we have an estate tax, and I'll show you a map around the country. There's a few other states that have estate tax and inheritance taxes. The big takeaway between estate tax and an inheritance tax is if you had an estate worth $10 million upon the death, that tax would be assessed based on the value of the estate, which is $10 million. In the case of an inheritance tax, if you had 10 descendants and each of them received $1 million, then they would each individually be assessed a tax based on the amount that they inherited. And those thresholds would be set based on possibly the inheritance amount or inheritance and the income of those individuals, so not determined by the size of the estate specifically. And then some states also have a gift tax. Oregon does not have a gift tax. And the gift tax, you might also know this, and at the federal level, individuals, I think the current amount.
14,000, I think.
It's 14.
Oh,
million.
It's under 15. Okay.
So that doesn't mean. Thank you, members. It doesn't mean that you're going to pay a tax every year if you give a gift. What it means is that amount that you give away as a gift during your lifetime may accumulate towards a final amount or a limited amount, depending on the state that you live in or from a federal perspective. And if you reach that cumulative amount over your lifetime, that can, depending on where you live, be set against your estate tax, or there's a limit that that you can give away as a gift tax-free. And so the difference between estate tax and inheritance tax and a gift tax is the gift tax can accumulate while you're alive towards these sort of things that you pass on through generations. And the estate tax and inheritance tax are both set at the time of death.
That's right. That's exactly right.
We have an estate tax in Oregon. Up until 2012, we had an inheritance tax, and then our tax system for estates was overhauled. Most states, I think until 2001, all states had a version of an estate or an inheritance tax. And that kind of started in 1926 with what was called the federal pickup tax. And that was a sharing arrangement between the states and the federal government so that if you assessed a state tax, that the estate itself would pay no more than it would if you hadn't had an estate tax at the state level, because the federal government allowed a sharing arrangement up to a level that would mean if you were paying, say, on an estate of $5 million, you paid an estate tax at the state level, that would be excluded from the federal level estate tax. And then the federal government removed this pickup tax, and over the past couple decades, the majority of states have started to phase out or eliminate their estate taxes. So when I say that in 2012, we overhauled our estate tax system in Oregon to become an estate tax instead of an inheritance tax, one of the key components was that the states, during the sort of era of a pickup tax, they all tied their estate tax at the state level to whatever the federal government allowed as part of that sharing arrangement. And as the federal government started to ramp down that dollar level that was allowed in the sharing arrangement, the states, some of them just didn't modify their law at all. And so it went, that the amount of the state tax went down to zero because the states had set their estate tax to be tied to whatever the federal definition was. And so in Oregon in 2012, we now have set our estate tax law to only be tied to federal definitions. And I'll talk about this in a little bit when we look at a part of a form for the estate tax. And so when I mean federal definitions, there are things like gross taxable estate, what that actually means, not the dollar values that are set at the federal level. We, for instance, have an estate tax threshold at $1 million. So if your estate is worth more than $1 million, you're required to file and without exemptions, and you would be required to pay tax in Oregon, whereas the federal level is currently at $11.4 million. That was $11.18 million last year. And the year before that, before the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, it was $5 million and change. I can't remember exactly.
Yes, Representative Rushkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are the amounts indexed to inflation, or are they just static amounts that need to be changed by the legislature?
In Oregon, I will show you the schedule, and it is fixed.
It's fixed.
It's unchanged.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Given our committee members' obligations, we're going to need to adjourn at 9:45, but let's continue right up until the last moment, and Mr. Alinek can arrange for time to continue on another day.
Okay. Okay. So I'm just going to make a little bit of commentary on the different states. Washington has, so these are all, the map here gives you the top tax rate. So the top tax rate in Oregon is 16%. That doesn't mean that a wealthy estate would be taxed entirely at 16%. It means the top portion of the wealth in that estate would be taxed at 16%. The top state in terms of those brackets is Washington. They top out at 20%. Something I noticed yesterday, was that New York, for instance, has something a little different than Oregon. They also have brackets like we do, which taxes the lower the less wealthy estates at lower levels and the smaller amount of wealth at lower levels. But what happens in New York, that once those estates hit a certain value, which is their threshold value, I think they are currently at 5.7 million, and they're moving towards the federal level. They're graduating up. Once your estate hits that value, you pay tax on the entire amount. You don't get any exclusion. So they have like what people call a cliff. And then there are states like Florida who have let their entire tax system phase out, but they also don't have an income tax, so that their structure is very different from ours. And we don't have a sales tax. So the states differ in lots of ways.
Let's do one more slide.
Okay. This slide is pretty simple. I like to consider things in extremes to get an idea of what's in between. And 100% estate tax just means that every generation, in some sense, would start from scratch. And all the wealth of your accumulated estate goes back to, for instance, the estate. You would not be taxed during your lifetime, so it's not a tax on income, but all your wealth at your death would go back to the estate. And a 0% tax allows wealth to just remain with the beneficiaries.
Thank you for that context. Was Representative Reschke, was there a question that we could get answered? Was there an additional slide that you said we were going to get to that was responsive to one of your questions?
Oh, the tax bracket.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Just
we got
this
there.
One
okay.
That is available, but we'll do that.
Okay. It was the next slide. Sorry about that. Yes.
Yes, no answer. Yes. Thank you. There is an exemption for agriculture / farms, right?
Yes. We have a natural resource credit.
Yes.
And that estate has to be worth less than $15 million and $15 million. So if you have a very large farm, you can't get it. And if more than half of the estate is involved in natural resource like agriculture, fishing, you're allowed an exemption. And I will talk in detail about that.
Yeah.
And there's some bills related to that as well.
So being responsive to Representative Hernandez's point that was made a few minutes ago, the context would be that at some point people wanted to express the legislature wanted to express the value that we support this type of activity, support more like family farms. Is that a way of paraphrasing this resulting tax structure? So that would be that would demonstrate the context and the social benefit or the value, or Oregonians' expression of value in creating this kind of a structure.
Madam Chair, I think that's right. There was a lot of conversation before the natural resource credit about what happens to a family farm if they have to liquidate to pay taxes. And that was the intent was in part to address that issue.
So, Mr. Alanak, I think that's the kind of thing that the representative was asking for us to have pointed out when it's something that you or your staff can help us understand. That this was the intent at the time. This is what we're getting at here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. So now there's no other business for today, and we just move on to our next time.
So the committee meets again next on Monday. Jamie will be back up. It's property tax. I was just taking a quick look at the agenda, and to come back to the estate tax, I left some room on the 30th of next week. So if the chair's pleasure, we would probably pick this up next Wednesday.
Okay. Thank you. We're adjourned.